Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is a talk by author Charlie Allison, given at the first annual Upstate Anarchist Book Fair, held May 4th and 5th, 2024, in Binghamton, New York. The subject of the talk was Allison's 2023 book, No Harmless Power, The Life and Times of the Ukrainian Anarchist Nestor Makhno. Makhno and the movement he began are seldom mentioned in most mainstream histories, Western or Russian, mostly on the grounds that acknowledging anarchist politics calls into question the inevitability and desirability of the nation-state and unjust hierarchies. Charlie Allison is an anarchist writer, storyteller, and activist who lives in Philadelphia. The Upstate Anarchist Book Fair was hosted by PM Press.
I'm Charlie Allison. I'm the author of No Harmless Power, The Life and Times of the Ukrainian Anarchist Nestor Makhno. Came out a little bit ago, I think 2023. So, quick question, so I know my audience and can sort of tailor the talk. We are at an anarchist book fair, so that should skew things at least a little. But show of hands if you've never heard of Nestor Makhno before today. All right, cool. Broad strokes version. I had this whole very political anarchist analysis of Makhno in later life lined up in case the vote went the other way of, yes, everyone here knows who Makhno is, Charlie. Don't condescend to us. Okay, we'll do the Cliff Notes version of, the first half of Makhno's life. When he was born, there wasn't really a Ukraine in the same way there's a Ukraine now. Ukraine had been folded into the Russian Empire under Catherine the Great in the 17th century, and nobody was happy about this. It did not go well. It was not a fun time. And the result of Catherine the Great slowly but steadily yoinking Ukraine was a deep and abiding passion in the hearts of the Ukrainian lower classes, farmers, and all that for land autonomy, basically socialization of the land, restoration of the commons, the ability to work their own land and not have to give all their food or labor away for little to no compensation, which is the system that Makhno was born into. He was a younger child. He had quite a few brothers, and unfortunately, his father died when he was about a year old. And when I say that Makhno was born in poverty, you might be thinking, yeah, but they had a house, right? And kind of. Makhno's mother, who is a scary, scary woman. A lot of Ukrainian peasant women are very scary, scary women. Makhno writes in his memoirs that, my mother, after my father died, decided to build a new house, and she just took bricks from everywhere and manually walked over and put them down and built the house that way. That sort of poverty where you're building your house out of essentially scavenged cinder blocks and wood. Every one of the Makhno boys worked from a very young age. Makhno worked as a sort of a drover and a, odd jobs is wrong to say, but farm laborer. And this is not a pleasant task now. You might be familiar with sort of the conditions on farms. If you're a migrant or poor, they are not nice. In the Ukraine, in the time Makhno is growing up, late 19th century, early 20th, beatings were considered sort of de rigueur, right? You would find it weird if you grew up in this timeline to not be beaten on the job because this was just the way it was. The reason for this is I told you a little bit about Catherine the Great and conquering Ukraine and absorbing it into empire. Part of that to keep people in Ukraine is reimposing serfdom, which means you're bound to the land. You can't leave your village. You have very few rights. And one of the ways that Catherine the Great keeps this going and into the 20th century is basically putting out a Craigslist ad hey, shiny new territory, need someone to run it for me, I'm busy, all serious offers considered. One of the people that answered this sort of posting, and by people, I mean groups of people, are German religious refugees called the Mennonites, who, if that sounds familiar, Yes, those Mennonites, who are sort of German people who are absolute pacifists, but set up colonies inside Ukraine that have a lot of wealth, power, and land, more importantly, which is where Makhno comes into it. He worked a lot as a child on the farms of the Mennonites, and so was pretty well acquainted with them. You know, the sort of master-slave relationship is there, but what that makes this interesting and why I'm talking about it is that Makhno was a weird little kid in the sense that he got along with, like, the children of his masters, right? Like, it's not typical for a Ukrainian serf to be playing with the boss's kid when he should be in the field and to escape punishment, which he did frequently, and this would actually save a couple of Mennonite families when the Russian Civil War came out, and Makhno is doing expropriations of Mennonite colony land. At one point, he actually stops an expropriation. He's like, whoa. That Jensen? The Jensen I used to play with as a kid? You're his widow? All right, expropriation's off. You know, you get a pass. So, you know, who you play with as a kid has long-reaching ripples, not always in the revolutionary sense, but yeah, who we hang around with shapes us. So that is a very digressionary way of saying that Makhno grew up in a very stratified, hierarchical society with not a lot of options to get out of it. So two things change this, like, there's no way out sort of mentality. And the first is that Japan, starting a trend that they will continue in the 20th century, sneak attacks Russia and declares war right after, which, from a purely pragmatic perspective, makes a lot of sense, but it's a kind of a move. So the Russo-Japanese War happens. Russia sends a lot of people over to what is now Siberia, and a lot of them die. Japan wins, or at least rather, Russia fails to win. There's a lot more going on there. So that is a crisis of, like, political and governmental legitimacy, right? We got beat by who? And they modernized, like, 2 decades ago? What the hell? Aren't we anointed by God and all that sort of stuff? Like, the Tsar's still, like, cool with God, right? And the Tsar, understandably, does not like people saying that perhaps things could be going better. And it's actually from the detritus of the Russo-Japanese War where protesters march on the palace with, like, Russian icon-style photos or paintings of the Tsar. Like, no, we love the Tsar. We want to support him. But also, what happened there, the Tsar orders troops to open fire on them. And these are, like, people who are pro-Tsar. And so that's how you get, at least many histories label this the start of the first Russian Revolution in 1905, which quickly expands beyond a mass shooting of pro-government protesters into the sort of, the nice phrase is, the dress rehearsal for the 1917 Russian Revolution. And this is where Makhno first becomes active in anarchist circles inside of Ukraine. It is not a very nice series of years. Makhno is busy doing expropriations, which often means, like, peasants would leave a lord's estate and come back and burn it at night because, one, we're not working your fields. This means we can work ours. Two, you're not getting any food either because you have been known to starve us. Makhno writes in his memoirs that, like, the burning of fields would go on for, like, a week at a time. And so this sort of burgeoning revolutionary movement starts trying to hold the land in common. Kropotkin is a lot younger at this time. He's not in Russia, but, like, his works are read. The idea of everything for everyone is a good summary of the general agrarian anarchist ethos, I think, even if it's a more modern saying. And Makhno is involved with his local activist group. There's a couple of very, maybe not funny, but grimly ironic stories about Makhno's early involvement. The first is him trying to make explosives on his mother's stove in a pan, and it doesn't work out, which is, you know, who hasn't at least thought about that, I guess? I don't know. But he's involved in what eventually becomes a lot of cloak and dagger work because the Russian government eventually realizes that, okay, so we can't put down this peasant uprising just by force. A lot of the people protesting are military or ex-military. This isn't going to work. And the Russian minister says, okay, or Prime Minister Stolypin says, all right, middle class. Are there any middle class people here today? This is Stolypin, not me saying this. Well, I'll make you a deal. So I'm sure you would like more land and rights. Well, what if, in exchange for helping put down this peasant and urban uprising, you get a lot more rights and a lot more property, and you get to privatize, basically. No more commons, no more sharing, but the middle class gets a big cut in exchange for helping put down this peasant uprising. And the middle class broadly, as a rule, says yes, and the anarchist or generally revolutionary tendencies are sort of isolated and popped out. The worst of it's done in 1906. Makhno is busy beyond 1906. He's sort of maybe not a fugitive, but he's farm worker by day, expropriator, or shooting at, you know, cops by night. This sort of very precarious existence cannot go on forever. He is eventually caught after a plan to blow up Okhrana, secret police. In our parlance, it would be like FBI building. He has a plan to blow it up. It doesn't quite go as planned. He's caught, imprisoned, and sentenced to death. And there are a lot of wacky misadventures in prison. He is ultimately relieved of his death sentence because his mother shamelessly lobbies and just goes for years and years against her son's death penalty. And it's reprieved at the last moment. He's moved to the large prison in Moscow, Bertia prison. And that's where his actual anarchist education outside of agrarian sort of communism or stuff like that begins, because political prisoners, ironically, in Tsarist Russia, had access to a lot of really good reading materials. It's here where he gets his hands on Mutual Aid. In his own autobiography, he writes, you know, I would walk around carrying and accosting people like, have you read Kropotkin? And every one of us anarchists knows at least one person, or has been that person at some point in our life, of like, I've just read this guy Kropotkin, he's based as f***, you need to read him. But Makhno's in prison and also doing hard labor. Katorga, I think, is the term, where you have to wear 8-pound cuffs on your wrists. They're connected to your waist and also run down to your legs. It's very Hannibal Lecter looking, but you're doing everything in your life with these weights on. So, if you're doing this the rest of your life is going to take some quality dives. He meets someone who will become very important for what will become the anarchist movement in Ukraine, Arshinov. They are, to use a very non-technical term, they're bros. And he asks Arshinov follow-up questions. What do you think Kropotkin really meant? And sort of like pesters him, but in a comradely way. Because Makhno is not a book learner. He's definitely more like, let's go and do the cool thing type of guy. Big chihuahua energy is a phrase that was cut from this book. But yeah, if that helps any. So Makhno's in prison from about 1909 to 1917. Obviously, we're anarchists, we're history nerds, or at least some of us are. In 1914, we all know what happens. Gets really f***ing real, and World War I happens. Why this matters is because this is another radicalizing point in Makhno's life, partly because the Russian Empire enters the war, and very quickly in the process of fighting it, realize, oh God, we RSVP'd to a thing we were not ready for, and start asking prisoners in exchange for an amnesty, would you join the army and fight on the front? And Makhno and the anarchists in Bertia, anyway, just sort of went like to that, right? Like, yeah, sure, I'd be out of prison, but I would be literally furthering the state's interests and I might die. This seems bad. Makhno writes in his autobiography that like, the social revolutionaries were a little bit better about this, and they're like, no, in principle, we shouldn't be involved in any wars. But, like, hands were thrown in prison between, like, the nationalists, Polish, Ukrainian, Lettish, about, like, who cares, we're out of prison. Obviously, this is better. This is a major fracture point inside of it. It doesn't matter, because the war obviously goes on for more than a day, about 3 years, and Makhno and a lot of the other anarchists and radicals are set free in February of 1917. What happens there is the Tsar's like, oh, wow, not only was I not prepared for this war and me leading in the front was completely unhelpful in every possible way, I have to abdicate. The strikes and social pressure and just sheer lack of credibility of my government means, like, the best way I can extricate myself is to extricate myself. K-bye. And this leads to a provisional government being formed under a guy called Kerensky, who I have some very mean words about in here. If you're looking for a Kerensky diss track, I've got some. But I understand time, space. Keep going. He figures the best way to take the sort of, like, boiling kettle of the Russian, what will become the Russian Revolution, and then the Civil Wars, off, like, to remove it from the heat, is, like, but what if we let out a lot of the political prisoners we have? That surely would make everything better. And yes, that is a thing that you should do, and it is cool, but it did not do what he intended it to do, which was to stop agitating for a revolutionary government as much as that is possible, or a new state of affairs. Makhno and Arshinov are let go. Makhno takes some time to recuperate because, you know, 8-pound irons aren't a joke for however many years that is. Arshinov stays in Moscow. He goes back to Ukraine and finds that things are quite changed. He gets back into the revolutionary movement. The police have fled. A lot of the rich people have fled because, you know, as all of us World War I heads might suspect, parts of Ukraine were pretty close to the front, or, like, the privations of war were not nothing. And so this means that Makhno gets to look through police records while expropriating from the people who are left and see, like, how many of my friends were snitches? And it turns out a lot. It's a sort of irony of radical movements in the European sphere and American sphere of, like, what the ratio of, like, actual anarchists and police informers are. Sometimes it's literally just police informers. Like, that's literally it. I think G.K. Chesterton described this scenario exactly in The Man Who Was Thursday, and that was written in 1907. Makhno does something interesting with the expropriations, both this time and after he comes back. He goes back to Moscow again, which I'm going to have to skip over for time. Which is that, unlike the Bolsheviks, who later in the Russian Revolution, their version of expropriation is, knock, knock, you have more than X acres of land. You can either serve the revolution in some arbitrary way that you're not suited to at all and die, or we can just shoot you and take your stuff, which is not really a good way to get people on board. Makhno, having grown up in the area, gave the landowners a chance to sort of an on-ramp to the revolution of, listen, you obviously have too much. You have more than you could ever possibly use. Hiring wage labor is pretty messed up. We will give you an equal allotment of what we divide your land up between the people who worked it, along with tools, seeds, animals. We're not going to leave you to starve like the Bolsheviks do to a lot of people, including the peasants, in the upcoming Russian Civil War. It's a very, I would say, inclusive method of early revolution because it hadn't had a chance to become violent yet. And then, of course, to skip past some really interesting stuff, the budding anarchist commune of Huliapolye, Makhno's hometown, is taken over by the Austro-Hungarians. Remember, World War I's still going on. Russia's out of the war, but no one really told the Germans that. And so he flees to Moscow, meets Kropotkin, his idol. They talk for a little bit. We don't have a great record of it. We only have Makhno's account. And he meets Lenin, who ultimately gives him papers to go back to the Ukraine and start up an insurgency against the Austro-Hungarians, which he does. It's here we sort of see Makhno's first written accounts of being anti-Semitic? Okay, seriously, doubling the anti in front does not help. Makhno is very clear, unlike a lot of Ukrainian revolutions and revolutionaries of his time and before, that he's not down with anti-Semitism. He comes back to the area around his hometown and people write letters, care of a friend, that Makhno reads, like, hey, we know X, Y, and Z collaborated. Should we blame the Jews for this? Like, are we going to do a pogrom? And Makhno writes back in, like, functionally all caps. I'm sure they had all caps back then, but it means something different now. Absolutely no, what the f- are you doing? No, 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 no. Being anti-Semitic is not even close to how we get a revolution going. Hold off. Don't do anything yet. We're waiting for the right time. In true anarchist form, a lot of people ignore this advice in the sense of ignoring it to take direct action against the Austro-Hungarians and start ambushing them when they come into towns or when they're vulnerable, and start calling themselves Makhnovists. So Makhno did not start the movement he's credited with, but he was able to do some remarkable things with it. Fast forwarding past a lot of political intrigue and backstabbing and wacky antics. It's hard to say wacky antics when the Russian Civil War is approaching like a hangover, but at the end of a year, by 1919, Makhno has formed a anarchist polity where the army elects its own officers. He has ultimate veto power, though, which little not great. It's a polity of free communes on a very agricultural basis, right? Ukrainian peasants are the core of Makhno's support. You know, there's a lot of other stuff happening. Like, he had a kid right after he came out of prison with someone he was corresponding with, but then that didn't work out. Anyway, so Makhno has formed the, you know, free territory of Ukraine, which is the 21st century term for an anarchist polity. They didn't want to be called anything that could be associated with the state. But one phrase that is kind of cringe, but I find very funny, is Makhnovia, which sort of has like a big egoopolis energy. Yes, like, you know, Alexander the Great way back in the day named like God knows how many cities, some variant of Alexander's city. Like, which Alexandria? Which Alexandropolis? Like, I don't know, there's 50. Ignore that historical tangent, but the point is, wasn't his idea to call it that. And their whole platform was the land should belong to, the phrase of the time is, the toilers, more of a direct democratic thing, no prisons. The Makhnovist strategy when taking over a town was empty out the prison and then dynamite it because we don't have any need for those in the New World. And this sort of army, this black army that Makhno and a bunch of other committed anarchists formed in the Ukraine, has a very ping-pong ball sort of relationship to time, space, and who they're fighting. Because while this is happening, the Russian Revolution and Civil War is unfolding. The Bolsheviks form the Red Army and dissolve the Red Guard. It's very confusing when two terms start with the same word and only the second word is different. It is really fun and good when you're doing historical research. You don't get confused at all. The Red Guards were all volunteers, like armed union members and factory workers that just picked up a rifle and fought for the revolution with no pay, broadly democratic systems, that sort of stuff. It's what saved the revolution in the early days. Trotsky was like, huh, this seems like too much democracy. What if we just took the worst part of the Roman legions and the old army and then just put red in front of it and then made it accountable to me? Seems great. I'm going to do that. And so the Red Army is fighting the whites, who are the old guard, the czarists, like military officials, the clergy, most of the political class. They're trying to retake the Russian Empire with help from like Britain, France, and America. Guns, ammo, experts, all that is being provided. So the Red and the Whites are fighting, but Makhno's Black Army is not a big fan of the Red Army, partly because since the Bolsheviks came into power, they started purging anarchists left and right. So they would fight both for quite a long period at a time, which is really punching above their weight. They enter into ultimately two very contingent tactical alliances with the Bolsheviks against the White Army when the White Army starting to get the upper hand. Both times the Bolsheviks betray the anarchists to the surprise of a surprising amount of people who've read the book, but I don't think this will be a surprise to anyone at an anarchist book fair, right? We all know authoritarian revolutionaries tend to be very fond of the old backstab. And yeah, Makhno is a key factor in holding on to revolutionary gains inside Ukraine. But the problem is when everything is militarized because you're in a civil war, you don't have really a lot of room for prefiguration, right? Like Arshinov, the guy he met in prison, his best friend, for a while anyway, sort of said, like, the best way to imagine the part of Ukraine we're in is, like, imagine, like, a grate of bayonets just sort of going up and down and up and down over the land, and just that's annihilating any chance to, like, build anarchist schools or create communes that last for more than a couple of weeks or give actual equal rights to women. All that's erased because everything is sacrificed to the exigency of fighting a war against both the Reds and the Whites. Long story short, the anarchist polity in Ukraine at its peak came to about 7 million people. Not all of them armed, obviously, but a significant amount of them were refugees or peasants. It was probably one of the more, like, I don't want to say stable, because, like, a civil war, no matter where you are, is not a walk in the park. War communism was starving the peasants to feed the urban centers, which sort of just redoubled Makhno's dislike of people in cities because they didn't get anything for it. In the end, Makhno and the anarchists who survived the Russian Civil War after the Third Revolution, after Kronstadt and a lot of peasant uprisings saying, in effect, hey, we didn't kick out the Tsar just so the Bolsheviks could come in, paint the palace red, and declare the revolution over and run basically the same systems but worse. Right? This is, again, preaching to the choir here. To the shock of everyone, probably including himself, Makhno survived the Civil War. He definitely was the lead from the front type. I think he had about 12 or so wounds he got in the Russian Civil War. Not all of them very pleasant. He flees and ultimately ends up in Paris with his wife and his daughter and some of his close friends. It is not a very nice last 10 years of his life in Paris. He dies in 34. He writes something called The Platform with his buddy Arshinov, which basically had every possible disadvantage when it was written. It's the old idea. Zoe Baker in her book Means and Ends talks about dual power or organizational dualism. That is, what is the role of anarchists in the revolution? You should be involved in, say, union struggles or protests or mutual aid, frontward-facing stuff. But you should also be in specifically anarchist organizations that are dedicated to spreading anarchist principles and acting with fellow anarchists, which tend to be a little bit more secretive and are not as front-facing. So that's the dualism. Makhno proposes pretty much the same thing with Arshinov, but it does not go over well. There are a number of problems. First, the translation wasn't good from Russian into French and into Italian, German, English. And so it's misrepresented as sort of a Bolshevization of anarchism due to bad translations. Arshinov did not help. Emma Goldman said about Arshinov that he has a Bolshevik soul, which, like, at the time is not a nice thing, especially if you just got out of Russia with, like, your life like this. And Makhno also, you know, I hate to put it in these terms, but he's kind of a Reddit lord when it comes to people he has decided were not working class enough. Like, one of the better historians of the Makhnovist movement is Volin, but because Volin was an educator and not a frontline fighter and wasn't a fan of the platform, Makhno would go out of his way to, like, make fun of him, smear him, slander him. It gets to the point where Alexander Berkman, who's, like, a fighty guy, writes a circular saying, in effect, Makhno, you need to lay off of Volin. It's 1927, Stalin's taken over, hooray, Trotsky's gone, but also, holy shit, international fascism is getting a lot of guns and money. We have more serious problems than your beef with Volin over the platform. We were chatting earlier about leftist infighting, so you can take comfort, guys. It's not just a 21st century thing. It's been happening literally forever. And so that means that, like, it's not necessarily all of our faults. Anyway, Makhno had made it very difficult for people to like the platform while he was alive. Obviously, the life of the platform is much longer than that of Makhno. The tendency escapes to South America. It is really big in South American anarchism and now North American anarchism. I'm supposed to write the foreword for a reissuing of the platform coming out from PM Press with Spencer at the helm of that. So look for that in 2026. But yes, so that is broadly speaking, in very, very, very exceptionally broad strokes, the life and times of Nestor Makhno. And I would love to take your questions and also to not be talking for whole seconds at a time.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a talk by author Charlie Allison, given at the first annual Upstate Anarchist Book Fair, held May 4th and 5th, 2024, in Binghamton, New York. The subject of the talk was Allison's 2023 book, No Harmless Power, The Life and Times of the Ukrainian Anarchist Nestor Makhno. The Upstate Anarchist Book Fair was hosted by PM Press.
So I want to talk about questions about when he was younger and when you're talking about the way that the young people were treated by the police and how that radicalized them, and thinking about like today, and I mean, kind of always, but also especially today, and what you think more specifically kind of was radicalizing to him and other people at that time to make that happen.
So Makhno's friendships as a young man or a child are fascinating. If he didn't decide that he hated you, he seemed to have a very magnetic personality. And this just applied to how he made friends. And I think more telling than how people were radicalized is, I don't know, there's a phrase that goes something like, you know, I may not like you, but I'll bail you out of prison or something along those lines. If you want to understand like how Makhno radicalized or how Makhno made friends, look at the list of people who bailed him out of prison as a young man, and you'll see a wider range of people. Yeah, family members, okay, if the money was around, but several times Makhno is bailed out of prison for expropriations or stick-ups by like small business owners or people who are in the relative 1% of his hometown, because like, the Makhno boy's in trouble. All right, I'll bail you out, but don't do that cool thing you were doing that got you in here. And Machno's like, well, I'm out, and I'm not going to promise that, but thank you extremely much. It's not fun being in jail, even for a little bit. With youth radicalization, more to the point, there was a generation and a half of Ukrainian and general Russian Empire youth, regardless of class, that went pretty hard revolutionary in one way or another. And part of it was the sheer amount of political damage the government had sustained up to that point. Like, no one takes anything the Tsarist government really has to say at face value. Like, yeah, I'm not going to listen to that. I'm going to go do something else. Right? So, like, there's the delegitimacy of the state, except for its armed branch. This just does not feel like today at all. And the sort of desire to do something new. It's really interesting to look at anarchism in the early 20th century, like through the artistic lens, because you have like the futurists who are all like, we have to destroy how we do language and just use incomprehensible stuff to get to the truth of art. And you're like, okay, I guess, but like, how's that helping with the revolution? And they're like, seems cool. So like this revolutionary wave is very widespread and interesting and cuts across all levels of society. And that definitely helped with radicalization, even in a relative backwater like Huliapolye, where Makhno grew up.
I'm curious like how impactful his anarchism was to like the local economies that he affected. And like, can we see any of his work that he's done like today? Because I feel like when I've like searched about him, it's been like very like niche or mentioned only like a few time in like Ukrainian like leftism. And then I guess I just have one addition to that. I'm curious, like once like peasantry was like less of a class structure during that time period, like what was like the leftist orientation of like most of the population? Like, was it still primarily anarchist or?
Yes, excellent questions. So as far as like economic impacts of the revolution, Makhno definitely, you know, if we anarchists had like tendencies just named after people like the Marxists do, like he would be a Kropotkinist, right? Like he was big into the idea of like getting rid of the intermediary form of money. I was never able to substantiate this, but he said all currency is legal in the Makhnovshchina and treated as the same, which drove people crazy. But like in terms of like direct exchange, he's like, okay, so the peasants have a bumper crop of X. We would like to send it to a nearby city, Alexandrovsk. And we know they have extra textiles, which we can use to make clothes. We want to coordinate an exchange of those. That happened. But at the time, Alexandrovsk was under Bolshevik control, and they did not like this idea of free exchange between a city they controlled and a city they did not. People might get ideas about abandoning money or constructing a gift economy, I guess is the phrase we'd use now. And while this went off, it took Makhno and the other anarchists and the citizens of Huliapolye like getting their guns and sending a telegram ahead like, hey, where's our shit? And if we don't get it, we're marching on you. because we really want those textiles. Also, you can't jerk us around, right? So it's very much a desire to have, I guess, you know, this term is poison, but like free trade between cities for equivalent amounts, which is a really interesting thing given how much Makhno hated cities. Economically speaking, like, I don't know, it's hard to get a good picture of Makhno because so much is informed by like the expediency of civil war, right? You do stuff that you would never do in a million years in the context of a civil war because the alternative is just death. So I'm not the best person to talk about that. Although Michael Mallett wrote one of the first biographies of Makhno in English, like in the 80s. And he's got a really good structure. I quote him in my book about how Makhno thought about things, how he dealt with people, and it's broken down by factions. You know, what did Makhno think of the White Army? They're bad. What did the White Army think of Makhno? He's also bad, right? And he goes through that whole thing, but there's a section, if I'm not mistaken, on the peasantry and on the formation of communes in revolutionary Ukraine. That's not even remotely comparable to the Catalonian collectivization, right? That sort of springs up in the Spanish Revolution where towns, cities, and farms all spontaneously collectivize and reinstall the commons and do this successfully with no loss of like output, and in some cases greater output, right? It's not the same because Catalonia had whole years where they weren't on the front line of a war. Ukraine was constantly switching hands, who's in control. And that means, you know, if you're an agricultural society, if you can't eat that food, you have to burn it. So it's hard to parse that. But yes, Michael Mallett's work on Makhno. I would also recommend Sean Patterson's Makhno and Memory. It's a really great work on Makhno's relationship with the Mennonites in Ukraine. And that gets into the economics of it too. Did I miss the second half?
There is just one, like once like peasantry was like less of a class, yeah. I guess that one, like what was like the leftist ideology? Did it like lean less towards anarchism or?
The peasantry is sort of dissolved as a class, or at least the anarchist peasantry that like would remember like the free territory by force. In the last stages of his fights with the Bolsheviks just, if you're in a Makhnovist territory, just kill everyone in this village. You can't do guerrilla tactics if there are no people to hide among. So just like complete razing of towns, men, women, and children, deliberately genocidal and meant to like deprive anarchism from holding out. Although I should note that like anarchism held out in like cities like Odessa into the 30s. There were general strikes that almost got it loose, but that's another topic. As for like when they become dissolved as a class, did they lean towards anarchism? I think, and this is the other end of the peasant question, is like how you demobilize a peasant army that's real at you is you do what Lenin did, which is say, hey, I've got this cool thing called the NEP that reinstalls a little bit of capitalism and maybe gets you some food and possibly some private property. And enough peasants are like, yeah, I've been fighting for a long time and don't have anything to show for it. I'll take half of a loaf instead of the whole bakery right now because I don't know whether I'll live to see tomorrow. And that also drives down the direct participants in the Russian Civil War at a critical juncture when it looks like all of the Russian Empire is like, nope, down with these fuckers. And it doesn't quite come off, unfortunately. So there's that. I think that there's another more interesting series of articles, I forget where they're from, that talks about like anarchists as counterculture in Soviet media and propaganda. Like Makhno lives on, but like as a bandit in Soviet movies and films and posters, and sort of like at first ironically gets a following, because if you're raised under the Bolsheviks, you're like, this guy wasn't a White Army guy and he killed Bolsheviks, seems pretty cool. So yeah, the anarchist counterculture that comes out of the USSR is part of it, but I would say broadly, a lot of the peasants or former peasants were more, I don't want to say cynically as a pejorative, but they were very practical of like, I can't eat my ideals and I have a possible out. So I'd say they would be leftish leaning, but not specifically anarchist because they want to get along and, you know,
When you mentioned that free state that was established by his followers, mm-hmm. that you refer to as Makhnovia, I was just wondering, isn't that around the same time when like Ukraine was independent for like a couple of years from 1918 to 1920? So I was just wondering, do you know anything in regards to like how he was connected or not connected to Ukrainian nationalism at the time?
Ah, yes. So Makhno has sort of a, and I talk about it in the book a little bit, a very sort of spiky relationship with Ukrainian nationalists. He particularly really did not like Petluria, the head of the nationalists. So like Ukrainian nationalism, there's a great article on Democracy Now, like Anarchism in the Homeland of Nestor Makhno, that talks about Ukrainian nationalism as a relatively left-wing phenomena in 1918 to 1920. Before, like, right now, it's a lot, like, I would say more chauvinist, if it's just nationalism, right? But anyway, so, like, Makhno did not care for Petluria because Petluria got off on a bad foot with him and the anarchists by saying, hey, it's great that the Austro-Hungarians aren't in your territory. Now, you just have to welcome back your old landlords, pay your taxes, and respect private property, and also let our trains full of troops drive through your territory. And Makhno's like, wait, you're serious? No, not even close. We'll let your trains through, but we reserve the right to stop them and issue propaganda and recruit from the soldiers. And all that other stuff you said about like respecting property and stuff, you don't have the manpower or the reach to enforce it, so we're just going to ignore it. And that's broadly what they did. They did fight them on multiple occasions. The Ukrainian nationalists have a really bad record, along with like the White Army, although they're obviously fighting for different reasons and different styles, of anti-Semitism as a recruiting tactic. There's a really good summary of how Makhno sort of thinks of Ukrainian nationalists right before one of the key battles in the Russian Civil War that Makhno wins. It's a big pivot point. He needs to unload his wounded, right? You can't fight a pitched battle if you're wounded or on the field. So the nationalists are the only army that might possibly be able to work a deal with him. And he says, okay, so listen, I don't like you and you don't like me, but if you take in our wounded, we'll remember it. And so during this meeting where they're working out the details, the Ukrainian nationalist officer stands up like, hey, Makhno, heard a lot about you, puts out his hand, and Makhno just does this. Let's just get this over with, right? He does not take the hand. He's very just like, I don't want to be here. This is a means to an end. Right, so like there's a great deal of animosity between the nationalists and the anarchists. That all said, that sort of changes a little bit after the Civil War ends. Makhno and Petluria's like government in exile of Ukraine sort of join up and write a document saying, yes, when we eventually go back to Ukraine, the Makhnovists will serve under Petluria's government. Blah, 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 blah. But they both know they're kidding themselves. It's way too soon. They don't have enough men. And Makhno's like, yeah, I'm not going to follow that, but I need some sort of diplomatic protection. Like, if someone tries to off me, I need the papers to say that the Bolsheviks tried to off a member of the Ukrainian government in exile's allies, as opposed to they tried to off an anarchist, because no one is very sympathetic to us right now. The change comes, there's actually a buddy of his when he's living in Paris, Vasily Zayats, which is a nickname. Zayats is rabbit, I think. And he was a Petlurist in the Russian Civil War, but he and Makhno met in a refugee camp and apparently hit it off, and he looked him up in Paris, and they stayed together for a little bit, but then Zayats committed suicide in Makhno's apartment, which is not a very cool thing to do for a number of reasons. So, like, when the war ends, you get some weird friendships or some weird, like, I'm not stabbing you immediately sort of things. And then, of course, like, you know how Petluria dies, right? Like, Shalom Schwarzbold, who is an anarchist and Makhnovist and also a Jewish poet, finds Petluria in Paris and, like, empties a revolver into him because Petluria's people had killed 14 members of his family in a pogrom. Right, so like, I don't mean to imply that everything was fine. It was not fine. Oh, and by the way, a jury lets Schwarzbold off because, you know, it had been very clearly this is a cool thing to do. If someone murders all your family, yeah, you should probably shoot them. It was actually, I think, Louis Lacoin, who is pretty instrumental in that case. He's also one of the lawyers who helps get Derruti and Ascaso out of hock when the French government impounds them after their streak in South America. Lacoin also gets Makhno off the hook when it looks like he's going to be deported back to the USSR. Right? It's like he convinces the police to lose the Makhno file. So, like, anarchist pacifists can do some pretty cool shit behind the scenes, historically.
I want to ask a question about the platform.
Do it!
Because we're doing this book in a couple of years. And I'm going to do it by asking a historical counterfactual, which, you know, I should not do as a historian, but what if? So part of my reading of the platform is that, in large part, it's Makhno trying to figure out, why did we lose the Civil War, right? Why did the Bolsheviks win? What did they do that, you know, they were able to win and we lost and now I'm in exile in Paris and my life sucks? And, you know, to be like, okay, the Bolsheviks, you know, for all their faults, they were very well organized, they were disciplined, they were concerned with, like, building and exercising power, and we as anarchists did a lot worse at that, and we lost. And so it's trying to figure out a way, and this is, you know, part of where the accusations of Bolshevizing anarchism comes from, to be like, okay, what can we learn from the Bolsheviks and, like, bring it into an anarchist framework and figure out how to be better organized and more disciplined, you know, have voluntary discipline. You know, to do this all in a way that will, you know, build and strengthen the anarchist movement so that we can actually, you know, make revolution. Do you think, as somebody who has studied all of this and wrote this fantastic book that everybody should buy because it's really good, do you think that Makhno is right? Like, could things have gone differently if, you know, the anarchists had been better organized, you know, if they had been united around a platformist organization like this, right? Like, do you think that history could have gone differently? And if so, does that, you know, mean that we should all be platformists? Or if not, you know, is that an indictment of the platformist model?
So if I understand the question, had Makhno's advice been able to be given retroactively, would that have changed the calculus in the Russian Civil War, at least in terms of the Bolsheviks winning? I think yes, but also in a different way than one might expect. God, it's hard to talk about this because the Bolshevik attack on, like, language is quite thorough, right? Like, anyone who's not a Bolshevik is a counter-revolutionary, which means SRs, Mensheviks, and anarchists, right? Anyone who's not our specific brand of revolutionary is as bad as the monarchists, the secret police, all of our enemies. So, like, we have to understand going into this that, like, the phrase counter-revolutionary is something the Bolsheviks take huge advantage of, and they use that to kill a lot of anarchists and fellow revolutionaries, right? And that, you know, makes the Civil War way worse. That lack of, like, vocabulary specificity, it also makes it hard to talk about. I think that if the platform, as Makhno envisaged it, had been in place, like, say, from 1917, like, before Makhno's really a thing, and, like, that had been the policy of, say, the Black Guards, who are the sort of urban Russian anarchists that are, like, the forerunners of a lot of the stuff that the Makhnovshchina, Makhno's territory, do very well, and there had been no collaboration with the Bolsheviks, I think it would have turned out differently. I think my analysis, and this is my personal, like, hobby horse, the mistake the anarchists made was ever cooperating with the Bolsheviks in the first place. But, like, it's easy to say that now. It's 100 plus years ago, right? I have the mother of all get-out-of-jail-free cards here. And, like, a bunch of anarchists joined the Bolsheviks in good faith, reasoning that, like, a revolution with them in charge is way better than the White Army winning. And, like, hard to disagree with that until you look at the Bolsheviks a bit more carefully. Serious names in anarchism, like Apollon Karelin, who had, like, an amazing beard. Like, it's, like, this big. Viktor Sergei, who had been an anarchist for, like, I think a couple decades at this point. Like, big names in anarchism were like, no, we gotta go towards the Bolsheviks because they're the ones who are winning right now. And if we want to have any chance of a stateless society, you know, didn't Lenin write that whole State and Revolution, which is basically an anarchist text because he thinks that's the way that the zeitgeist is going? Isn't this really good for us, is the state anarchist sort of view? Certainly Shapiro thinks that, the anarcho-syndicalist, in articles he writes as the October Revolution is going on. But like their collaboration with the Bolsheviks, while understandable, gives them like a monopoly on revolutionary terms and defining what is okay and what is not okay. If the anarchists had all been following the platform, more organized, not making deals with the Bolsheviks that like compromise them, like taking part in government, I think that it would have not allowed the Bolsheviks to do what they did, which is to hunt down every other left tendency and put them under the gun. Militarily, who knows? That's always a crapshoot. I think that that's impossible to prognosticate. And in that one way, military and sports are kind of the same. And they're like, yeah, I know there are rules. And like, you could be really, really good at it and still lose. But like, it's a coin flip. Who knows? So yes, I think the short answer to your question is, if there had been no collaboration and no buying into the Bolshevik terms, it would have gone very differently. And an insistence on an explicitly anarchist society would have had weight with the Russian Empire's people. I think Bakunin said, like, you know, the Slavs are basically natural anarchists, which, like, can be true of almost everyone who isn't industrialized and then under a hegemonic government. In closing, and I'll say this because, you know, you're a historian and you'll appreciate this, I feel like the mistake the anarchists made was the same mistakes the anarchists made in the beginning of the Spanish Civil War, which was, like, you made a deal with a government body and now you can't unfuck that, right? Like, you need to not work with them in a way that like compromises your vision. And because of that, the Spanish anarchists got screwed over. The communes were destroyed by like communist death squads that went through and forcibly reimposed private property. Like, this is not a secret. This is why I'm not just a regular communist and why I'm an anarchist communist, right? Like, this is some bullshit. Sorry, that was not the greatest last sentence. In essence, the mistake is collaboration instead of insisting on this is a specifically anarchist thing.
I have two questions. One is a story I read so long ago, and I've always wondered whether it was true, and I haven't, I don't remember where I read it, but it was this story about some guy who wanted to carry out pogroms and asked Machnow to help him, and Machnow invited him into his camp, and when the guy arrived, he just stabbed him to death. Mm. I don't know if this is a real story or if it was one of those like early, you know, very early on CrimeThink used to make those stories that were like not exactly true, but were like written for mythic.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I'm like, was it one of those things? Because I haven't seen it anywhere else. So I'm wondering if you have anything to say about that. The other is, could you speak to the relationship between platform and Latin American especificismo?
Yes, absolutely. Although that last one I will not speak on with any sort of expertise. So there are a bunch of stories like that, and most of them seem to have a basis in fact, if they are verified. The stabbing's new? So I'll list three quick incidents that like have the same traits. The first and most dramatic is during the course of the Civil War, independent sort of Cossack warlord, Grigoriev, had been allied with the Red Army, and then he's like, yeah, this is not fun now that the Red Army's sort of losing, so I'm taking my ball, and I'm going to set up my own private kingdom, and, you know, just sort of go with who wins. You know, it'll be fine. And, you know, if I do some pogroms, it'll, you know, it's great, is what Grigoriev is saying. But this is terrible for Machnow, who's at the time allied with the Red Army. Grigoriev joins the Machnovist movement, and very quickly, Machnow invites him to one of the towns he controls. Grigoriev is due to make a speech or whatever. Machnow instead preempts him and says, by the way, you're not a revolutionary. The crimes you've committed, they're too many to forgive. Sucks to suck, basically. And Grigoriev is shot on the platform next to Machnow. It's unclear whether Machnow shot him himself or one of his aides and one of the more interesting Machnovists, Chubenko, shot him with a holdout pistol. But like his movement is integrated into the Machnovshchina. The people who could be proved to have participated in pogroms are executed without trial. Because that is pretty much the way things were done in the Civil War. Like any sort of trial is not happening, really. The second is a incident at Pologi Station in Ukraine, where a guy has put up a poster saying, you know, save Russia, beat the Jews. And Makhno goes up to the station master and he's like, hey, what's that sign about? And the station master's like, do you like it? I put it up there myself. Huzzah. And Machno's like, I really don't like it, and just shoots him, just out of hand. So, like, the whole taking him back and stabbing him thing, absolutely in character. It was very clear that Makhno viewed that as something that was going to eat up the revolution from the inside, as if you make it along racial or religious lines, you have almost no appeal. It's also morally wrong, and what the f*** is wrong with you? Obviously, like, let's be clear about that, but, like, and also, from a tactical perspective, it's a terrible idea, besides the many, many moral problems with it. So, yes, as for Especifismo, the specifically anarchist organization, Fora in South America, I think it's Argentina, were a huge tendency. I'm actually editing a book from an Argentine writer who talks about the revolutionary history of platformists and syndicalists who tend to get along quite well, actually, anarcho-syndicalists and platformists. They tend to be at the same parties anyway. Especifismo, I think, is a further development just based on, like, the nature of cities in South America. I am really not the person to be talking about this. But, like, neighborhoods and barrios are very tightly knit. And, oh, also Dr. Raymond Crabe is amazing, and he has a great piece on a Chilean anarchist who, while not necessarily a platformist, he was alive before then, talks about neighborhood bonds and solidarity and face-to-face relationships that go a long way towards building a revolutionary movement block by block. Especifismo is really helpful, I think, for knitting those blocks together outside of your immediate sort of, like, zone. And, you know, the also long history of labor organizing in South America sort of feeds into it, I think. I could tell you more, but I'd have to read the platformist books that I have again. So I hope that was helpful.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode was a talk by author Charlie Allison, given at the first annual Upstate Anarchist Book Fair held May 4th and 5th, 2024 in Binghamton, New York. The subject of the talk was Allison's 2023 book, No Harmless Power, The Life and Times of the Ukrainian Anarchist Nestor Makhno. Charlie Allison is an anarchist writer, storyteller, and activist who lives in Philadelphia. The Upstate Anarchist Book Fair was hosted by PM Press. You can download this audio for free via radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. Thanks for listening.